Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. My name is Mark and I'll be hosting today's webinar. Today our topic of discussion is the new Chinese contagion. We're going to uncover some of the demographic changes in China, global wage growth, and the issues that the Australian economy is facing. And of course, we will cover the investment implications of all of this. Today we're joined by Damian Klassen, Head of Investments at Nucleus Wealth. Good afternoon, Damian.
Hi, Mark.
Before we start, quick housekeeping message, a reminder as usual to subscribe to our YouTube channel and click the bell to be notified when we go live or when new material has been uploaded you can watch. Alternatively, you can follow us on your preferred podcast. For those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat and have them answered along the way. And with no further ado, Damian, over to you.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, wanted to have a bit of a deep dive into Evergrande. So it's obviously been sort of front of the papers and front of the press for the last week or so, and we've been talking about this for for a while. And I guess I just wanted to sort of dig into it because to steal from the heading is that Evergrande is very much a symptom of what's going on. It's not a cause of what's going on. So you can't just look at this and say, oh, well, if only somebody would just throw a bunch of money at Evergrande, then everything will be solved and everyone could go on happily on their way, because there are other deeper issues behind this. And so and you need to look at what's going on with those issues, because that's where you really get an insight into what's going on and how much bigger it could be. So I might start with let's start with the urbanization side of it, because the issue for China is that they've actually been urbanizing a lot faster than anyone thought. And I've got these two couple of charts up here showing the urbanization rate for China. And the top one shows just sort of two different scenarios. One is, and they look like there's barely any difference between those two lines. And what it's doing is it's growing from China's current position, which is roughly about a little bit under 65% urbanization, and growing to I've topped it out at 83%, and that's roughly where the US and the UK are. So that's a pretty aggressive sort of forecast in terms of urbanization for a country of China's size. It's that would put it above somewhere like South Korea, that sort of topped out at or has topped out so far at sort of the low 80s. It's well ahead of somewhere like Germany, which is more like 77%. So I guess what I'm getting to is they're not particularly not a particularly conservative forecast. You can easily come up with scenarios where China tops out at much lower levels and things will look a lot worse. Then the second chart, the one below it, shows what does this actually mean in the number of people moving into cities? Because the real push for growth in China has been that every year there are more and more people moving into cities. And over the last 10 years, from 2010 to 2020, everyone thought that had peaked and that it started going, that it was already starting to fall, and that China would sort of go through this path, this sort of relatively smooth path to a higher amount of urbanization, but you wouldn't see sort of dramatic falls in terms of the number of people moving into cities. What that bottom chart's showing, though, is that if you're going to follow the that bottom sort of more smoother path, which is sort of following from so it's a more smoother transition to sort of flattening out, then the urban population is going to start falling. The number of people moving into cities is going to start falling, and falling really, really quickly from now already. And the alternative is that China can perhaps keep moving, 25 million people to a city per year for the next, 2 or 3 or 4 years. But if they do that, then they've literally run out of people, and then the rates are going to have to drop, even more dramatically. And so I've got those two charts then on the next one, which is this sort of bar chart showing just the decades. And so I'm saying, let's have a look at the next decade. And you've got the two lines there, the green and the red, the two bar charts, one showing that in the best case, there's about 20% people 20% fewer people moving to cities in the next decade than what we saw in the last decade. And in that, in the other case, we're actually seeing a third less people moving into cities. And so that makes a huge difference to what's happening in terms of the Chinese developers. So really, we've had this huge Chinese development sector build up, all on the back of this massive increase in urban population. And if you look at just some of the numbers, are relatively staggering when you think about it in terms of the global sense. Is that if you look at all the property developers, all the listed property developers right around the world, and you add up all of their equity plus all of their debt and put it all together, Chinese companies make up, or Chinese and Hong Kong companies make up 75% of all the market cap plus debt that you get within that sector. So is that a sustainable model? Is it sustainable that China can do that? And for us, it's pretty clear that no, that's not sustainable. China's more like 10% of GDP, and so that's more likely to where you'll see the size of that development sector come back. So the development sector has to shrink at some stage. There has been questions about will it be now, or can they eke out a few more years? China's had a couple of goes at slowing it down. So they had a go in 2011, and they started winding back on the debt, trying to consolidate the sector and slow everything down. The problem was the economy coming out of the financial crisis. It actually slowed too quickly, and so they ended up going back to lots of debt and lots more property building and lots more infrastructure.
Sorry, Jamie, if I could just interject for a second. What about the existing oversupply of apartments in the cities? I mean, we've discussed this over the last few weeks about all the unfinished apartments, and there's close to, 20% more than they need. Wouldn't that accelerate the whole process of slowing down?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the other big issue is, estimates vary, but the thoughts are it's roughly sort of 50 to 60 million apartments that are empty within China. And so they've sort of built enough to house effectively you get like three people to an apartment, so you could effectively house another 100 to 150 million people sort of just in what they've already built. So that's basically saying you've got 3 years worth of urbanization that's already been built, ready to go, and so some of that will be demolished. And we saw, there's a video. I don't know if we posted it. Got posted on the Macro Business site, but I don't think we posted it on our site. But there's a video that's of about a month ago where a Chinese developer demolished sort of 15 buildings all in one go. It's quite a dramatic video of 15 buildings all of a sudden all collapsing, and these were ones that were built in 2014 in one of these tier three cities, and nobody's ever really lived in them, and no prospect for it, so they just demolished the lot.
Right. Redefines the words tear down, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So you could do that on a grand scale within China and still wouldn't make a dent in sort of the overspend. I guess it's this whole issue when people get onto a good thing, and moving people into cities was a great thing in China, but it just goes to show that as is typical, people just extend it way too far, and all this extra building, property prices were going up, people couldn't lose. Yep, borrow more money, build more property, property prices keep going up, you make a fortune out of it, and then it does look like now is the time to pay the piper though. Potentially they could extend it. I mean, I spoke about it in 2011, they lost their nerve. They tried again in 2015, and we actually had a commodity price crash in 2015. And then the same thing happened, lost their nerve, went back to the whole building structure, building an infrastructure. Then we saw 2019, they had another go at it. The issue for Australia in 2019 is we really didn't notice as much because at the same time Brazil had its issues with iron ore and took a whole bunch of iron ore out of the market. So the iron ore price actually held up while China was slowing down. And then secondly, early 2000s, the coronavirus hit. And so then China went back to, they needed a stimulus to get them out of that. and that the tried and true way is to go and spend lots of money building apartments and go and spend lots of money on infrastructure. And so that's, you know, as that was sort of understandable. And so, but now they're back to, you know, trying to rebalance. And so we have seen some sort of rolling over. So, actually one more thing on the building side. I've got this, the other is that China doesn't actually release stats on how many actual apartments and how many houses are being built. What they release on is floor space. So it is a little bit confusing in that you have had more people are getting bigger houses over there. But the flip side as well is there's becoming fewer people per household. So, you know, you sort of got a few things moving in each direction. But the net effect is, so we spoke about this, the apartments that don't have people in them. Well, for the last 10 years or so, China's been starting about twice as many apartments as what they've been completing. And it's about twice as much as what, twice as many apartments per new household. And so what that means is they actually have maybe about another 6 or 7 years of houses under construction already. So we spoke about stuff that's finished and just not occupied. Well, if you also got to add in, there's a bunch of apartments and houses that are under construction, haven't been finished yet. Some of them will probably never be finished, based on the Evergrande experience. But there's also this huge weight of unfinished apartments sort of sitting there as well, sort of hanging over that market.
Yeah, plus the fact in the Chinese market, they don't finish apartments, just put up the structure. They don't do the interiors until they rent it out or sell it or whatever have you.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're just left with shell of a building as such.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's sort of from a, you know, I guess it sort of makes a lot of sense in a way. If you're going to build something and no one's going to move into it, then rather than putting your kitchen and your flooring and your painting and all that type of stuff, and then having to worry about that depreciating and, you know, you haven't had anyone living in it and you've got to, you know, in 5 or 10 years' time, you've got to start replacing some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does make a lot of sense to have nothing there, and so that when, you know, when people do want to move in, you get to do it all brand new. Mm. But the flip side is you've obviously wasted a lot of iron ore and steel and cement and all this stuff just to stick up an empty box in the sky. Mm-hmm. It's not a productive activity for an economy, and China is getting more and more focused now on equality. They're more and more focused on not just trying to get some developers rich. They're actually trying to get everyone rich. And so, and so that sort of comes back to that point that there's just way too much building going on within China. And so, yes, Evergrande is the biggest and the most indebted. And so that's where we're seeing the warning signs first. But there is a wave of other companies sitting behind Evergrande that are very similar in nature. They're all over indebted. They've got about three times as much debt as what the average developed market, mm-hmm. or actually even just not even developed market, the average property developer anywhere else in the world outside of China has about three times less debt than what you see in the Chinese companies. So something needs to be done to fix that sector. And so that's where, you know, the thoughts are that what happens to Evergrande is probably going to need to happen to another dozen or more developers behind Evergrande. And they are all going to have to shrink. They're all going to have to do less. And that just means that a lot of this debt, you know, may never be paid back. And so the question is, does China take that all on board? Does the government just take that and they face lower growth for everyone? Or do they let some investors take some pain? And I think, from my perspective, they will certainly let international investors take the pain.
Yes, obviously.
Yep.
But yes, given that I think the majority, I think it's over 60% of Chinese have their savings involved in property, so the pain would be quite severe, I would think.
Yeah. So, well, home ownership in China is close to 90%. It's way higher than most other countries. So yeah, so you are, if property prices fall, you're going to be you're not going to be popular. And a lot of them, they don't have as much household debt, behind it. So the leverage ratios aren't as bad as what you'd see in a country like Australia, but they're still, it's still there, and there still will be a lot of people very unhappy about the whole. I think China's got a similar outlook to Australia in that a lot of Australians, in that for a lot of people, houses are very safe. They never go down. You put your money in, and all you see is an increase, and so you gear up as much as you can, and off you go. Whereas, obviously, investors in most other countries around the world, it was only a decade or so, or 15 years ago, so they all saw house prices take massive tumbles. So they're a little bit more, let's call it realistic about, the path for prices, and don't sort of put as much faith in the in that.
Does the leverage in the you said there's a low leverage in housing. Does that extend to the investment properties as well, or just for the owners occupied?
No, that's across the board. And they generally have much stricter rules for the second and third houses as to how much you can borrow within it. I'm not 100% sure about what the latest ones are, but I know at one stage, on your second house, you couldn't borrow more than 30% of the available, that was your leverage ratio. So on your ordinary house, it might have been something like 60%, and then for the second or third houses was significantly lower. So they don't have as much of that problem. The problem is more in the corporates, in that these corporates have just grown so big, and spent the last few years, trying to maintain the pace of everything by overbuilding and using debt to get there, and so now they're in the point of saying, well, what does that actually mean for? at some stage, that has to come unstuck. So the next chart I wanted to show was this starting to roll over. So we've got the residential floor space starts that have sort of started to come off. So we're back to sort of 2020 levels, or close to where it bottomed in 2020. There, keep in mind that these are, because of apartments, take a long time, that these tend to have to be quite long lead as well. So things you start will take sort of 2 or 3 years often before they come to a finish. So there's the floor spots. Then we've got the other thing I wanted to highlight is China's share of the global commodities demand. So I've got another chart up, which is sort of just showing that, say, of iron ore, the first line, seaborne iron ore, China's got like 70-odd% of the global amount of, seaborne iron ore. And it's that same point. China doesn't have 70% of the world population and nowhere near 70% of the world's GDP. There's no reason for them to need so much iron ore, except for the fact they've been running this huge model to do so much building. Because most of the building is done within that, and so if you look then, that ranges across a whole bunch of different commodities. So nickel, aluminium, copper, zinc, all while they're not the main ingredients, I guess in terms of a house, they are all. Chinese housing is a significant part of the demand for it. And so if I look at the next slide, then I'm just showing China's steel versus the rest of the world. You can see it's just come from nothing in the early 2000s to more than the rest of the world put together. And that was that's only 2019. And so if you said, okay, well, let's say China doesn't, you don't even have to be that bearish on the whole thing. If you said, well, what would happen if they went back to the same levels that they were, 2010? And you're talking about a 30% fall in the amount of steel that they need, or 40% fall in the amount of steel. So we're not talking about saying, we're not talking about sending everyone in China back to living in the countryside or in huts or everything like that. They're saying just by taking, back to where you were when you were already moving 20 million people every year into cities, it would make a huge dent in the steel market. It would also make a huge dent in copper, aluminium, nickel, all these different other ones that would all flow through in terms of because the amount being used in terms of Chinese building is just so huge.
Would any of this be covered off by perhaps the automotive industry, for instance? Or
no, so you can see, well, steel is a good example. On this chart, we've got there steel, six vehicles are 6%. So,
oh, okay.
And the housing's 56%. So, yeah, a 10% fall in the housing market, you'd need to double the amount of cars to get back to the same. Copper is very similar in that the amount of copper being used in cars is less than 10%. And so, yeah, you need, again, you just need such a massive increase in it that there's no feasible way we could see that coming over the next few years. I mean, the copper growth due to electric vehicles, we've done a couple of times in blog posts and podcasts. You need about 1% more copper every year. Any fall in Chinese building is going to wipe out any extra demand from these other sources. So that was that market. The other thing to note as well is the recycling as well. So recycling within China is not particularly high across a range of different materials. Now, they have started a whole program to try and increase those. So and steel is a great example of one where the recycling hasn't been high, but a lot of that is because most of the steel sits in buildings. And as China's moving somebody out of a rural hut into a high-rise apartment somewhere, you know, knocking down a hut doesn't give you any steel, and you need a lot of steel for this new high-rise. But if we're seeing like that video of the 15 buildings all being demolished last month, there's a lot of steel within those. You know, you demolish 15 buildings, you've got now enough steel to go and build a whole bunch more.
But it's obviously not easy to get that steel out. It's like you said, it's embedded in the concrete. You can't exactly melt it out.
They get most of the steel out of buildings. That's where, most of the source. So somewhere like the US runs, I think, it's either in the 70s or 80s, the amount of recycled steel versus needing fresh steel. China's more like in the 30s or 40s. So, there's plenty of and that's actually the key source is buildings, because when they demolish the buildings, they want to get rid of them. They want somebody to come and carry this stuff away, and there's actually two different types of steel furnaces you get. Mm-hmm. And the electric arc furnaces are the ones that use recycled steel, and that's way cheaper to produce steel than using it from iron ore. So commodities, if China's going into slowdown, and how can I put this again? So there is still there's still the possibility that China will lose its nerve and it will reverse and say, actually, things are slowing faster than what we thought. Let's throw a bunch more at the property sector and let's put it off as a problem for another 2 or 3 years. They are going to run out of time soon, but they certainly could do that again. It looks though, based on all the feedback we're getting, that they are relatively serious this time, and they do know how big the problem is, and they know they have to move away soon, and it's better to do it now than to wait to the last minute. And then, you know, as I showed on that other graph, you know, you're going to get another 5 more years in the sunshine, but then you're really in trouble. Then you're really into a massive crash. Whereas you'd be much better off trying to move away more gradually. Okay, so that was the building side. The next chart I've got there is just a plot of the top 20 odd companies, and just showing actually the third column in that is the amount of debt compared to the enterprise value, and the average company around the world, the average non-Chinese company around the world, that number's about 20%. Mm-hmm. And as you can see, looking down that sort of column, it's 90%, it's 80%, it's, you know, you get a few 70s and 60s every now and again, but they're just, it's chalk and cheese compared to the rest of the world. There is a lot of debt sitting behind these. And that's the danger, is that China's trying, they want to diversify away from this, they want to shrink the sector. If they do it too fast, they might end up with a debt crisis. So that's sort of number one. If they don't do it too fast, if they reverse and try and bail these guys out, the cost is going to be astronomical, because it's not just Evergrande, Evergrande's got, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of debt, but there's plenty more other companies behind it that are not too dissimilar.
I've seen figures ranging somewhere in a couple of trillion dollars, isn't it, in total debt?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Evergrande on its own, look, it's hard to tell because it's got a lot of these funny off balance sheet structures. But Evergrande alone is probably 300. Could be more. And so, you know, you add on all these others, easily get into the trillions of dollars. And so, and Evergrande as well. This isn't a sudden thing. It's not like suddenly people woke up a month ago and decided, hey, this Evergrande company looks like it's in a bit of trouble. This has been going on for 2 or 3 years now. The concerns have been there, elevated issues with the debt, trying to put on a bunch more regulations, pretty much targeted at Evergrande, called the three red lines to try and rein in the debt excesses. So Evergrande's been selling assets all the way to trying to get itself into a better position. It's been selling the properties as fast as it can. The issue is when you're 3 years into it, the properties that you sold 2 years ago and a year ago, they were all your best properties. You got rid of everything you could. Anything you get rid of, you did. And so all your best properties are out. So what's left means these are the properties you couldn't sell.
The first time around, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's again, you look at the balance sheet and say, well, are the assets really worth what they say they're worth, or are they just going to really have to discount a lot of those to actually get the money out?
Out of curiosity, we've said that Evergrande is the second largest construction company in China. What's the story with the largest? Which one's the largest?
Well, it depends on how you want to measure it. I think of them as being the look, Evergrande used to be the largest. Most of the problem is because their market cap shrunk so much. Mm-hmm. Country Garden Holdings, which is like the fifth or sixth one down on that list, sometimes gets touted as the largest. Sometimes it's China Vanke. So yeah, but it's I guess the thought is, given these guys, given how much their share prices have been crashing, that's where
to me, race Evergrande, to the bottom, race to the bottom.
Yeah, that's right. And which one's in front, which one's behind, I think is a little bit not that important, but
exactly
more the knowledge that they're all going to suffer problems within this. Okay, so that's that side of it. The funding side, I want to sort of step on and just have a quick look at the funding. So I've got a chart up of the this is the high yield index for China. Now, companies could borrow at sort of 8% about a year ago, and pre-COVID, they could borrow at about 8%. That's now closer to 16%. So the issue that's happening, you know, the issue growing in that market is there might have been companies out there that were fine with 8% debt or 10% debt on paying on their debt, but if they have to pay 16, they're going to be in trouble. And so the issue for this one, or 15, sorry, the issue comes then that they issued debt, you know, a few years ago at 8%, and they've got a viable business and they're growing. They might even be, you know, they're break even or slightly cash flow positive with that. And they've got a truckload of debt, and then the debt expires and they have to go out and get new debt, and they're doubling their interest rate. And all of a sudden, exactly, this company goes from being a break-even, slightly profitable prospect to all of a sudden loss-making. And that's the danger of this financial crisis within these developers, is how is China trying to, you know, they can't bail, well, if they bail the whole thing out, then they're really going to weigh down their economy in terms of growth for years and years and years, and you get all this moral hazard. So they're probably not going to do that. At the other end, if you let it go too far, you've got a financial crisis because these things start falling over, house prices start to crash, everyone loses faith in the system. You know, a lot of this debt was they thought they were sort of backed by the Chinese government, and you could really see some things freeze up. And property is such a huge percentage of the Chinese economy, and so it's trying to get somewhere in the middle that does enough that to punish the people who have been overgeared and done too much, but not so much that you see a financial crash. And that's the danger they're sitting in at the moment, and why, you know, we're quite conservative with our portfolios, sort of looking at this, saying, okay, it's not just an Evergrande issue, and maybe they'll come up with a solution that fixes things for Evergrande and markets will boom on it. But if that's the case, you know, we'll do what we need to do within portfolios, but we're not going to forget about the issue because it'll just be back in another year or 2 years or whenever the next company either suffers the problems and starts to go through that same process. So that's the funding markets. The other thing on the funding side is to note that I've got the next chart sort of showing, first of all, a longer term look at property developer debt compared to Chinese GDP. So, you know, in the financial crisis, it was back down sort of 10% or below, and household mortgages to GDP was roughly the same. Now they're both over 30. So you've got, let's call it 15% if you put the two together. Back in sort of 2006, you had 15% of the economy was either debt to property developers or individual houses. Now that level's over 60. So
wow.
You're, it's not the same. Yeah, and you can just see so much of this growth in the houses since then has been because of debt. And we saw how much steel was being produced, you know, back in 2010. That was 30-40% less. All the overbuilding, like it just says, there's at some stage they need to come back to a sustainable rate of building.
I mean, given the overbuilding, it must be a very tough market to sell a property.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where, and that's part of the Evergrande's problem, is that they're quite heavily discounting. Mm-hmm. But still having problems getting away from selling these properties mainly in the second and third tier cities. And keeping in mind that a second or third tier city in China is probably bigger than Sydney or Melbourne. Like we're not talking small cities. Like they'll have, you know, 5 to 10 million people in some of these cities that you've just never heard of. And they're treated, but have just overbuilt the, in terms of the number of apartments.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the second chart on that is just showing how a couple of different types of loans to developers and mortgages, just how they've both been slowing. So loans to developers has now gone negative. Housing mortgages are also running down, but it's been this regulation. The regulators realize that this is a problem, they need to cut back on it and are trying to do what they can. It might be, While there's a school of thought that says, oh, all we need is a bailout for Evergrande and then everything will be fine. I think everything will be fine for a couple of weeks or possibly even a couple of months or so, or you know, pushing out to a year, but that this problem is still overhanging and isn't going to go away.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, I thought I'd leave it as a relatively quick one this week. So, you know, in terms of investment implications, for that, we're talking about, you know, really being cautious. We've spoken several times over the last few months about this growth scare based around a Chinese slowdown. So if you remember our growth scare thesis was that, our growth scare thesis has been that there's two parts to it. One is that China was slowing, and in particular in the property sector, and that would then flow onto world growth. And secondly, that we would see in the US, you've got a handoff between all these checks have been sent out to retail investors and mums and dads at home, and they were spending it. There's infrastructure spending, which is coming, but mm-hmm. that hasn't started yet. And even once it starts, will take a while to ramp up. And there's this sort of hole in between where you've got the potential for a growth scare in the US as well as within China. And so what that means for all these ones is, commodities in particular are going to be really volatile, and we've been avoiding them. There's a whole energy crisis factor going on, which we'll probably have a longer look at next week. But there's certainly an energy. There's a number of issues in terms of shortages in the energy sector and high transport costs that are complicating matters. For us, we're really trying to stick to the idea that you want assets preferably priced not in the in Aussie dollars. You are probably going to see an Australian income shock. Well, you will see an Australian income shock in terms of the falls we've already seen in commodity prices, but with a lower Aussie dollar as well. And we're expecting to see that value stocks are probably not going to be the right place to be within this, as this all sort of fades into inflation falling off as well, and generally lower. So we've sort of within our own portfolios, we're trying to keep some spare cash so that as markets come off, we can start investing. The question is, you know, as always, when do central banks and governments step in to lend support? Because the markets are really being held up by central banks and governments at the moment. And so that's what we're looking at, is as some sort of that will help guide our decision as when the right time to jump back in is, because you're knowing that we're in a market that's manipulated and by governments and central banks in terms of propping it up and throwing lots of cash in there, that's one of the key things we need to watch as a decision to buy or sell. So yeah, I don't know if we've got any questions. I haven't actually been watching the questions there, Mark.
No, nothing coming in actually. No, just Brett made a comment. Nothing in life is free, and that's true.
No, that's right. But yeah, so I mean that it is. Well, I guess we'll put the call out for anyone with questions to pop them in. But I guess the big picture, you know, really is we've known for a decade or more that what's happening in China is unsustainable and it can't last forever. Despite that, it's actually headed in the wrong direction. It's been growing faster than what you would have thought. It's been debt backed, and so you know it has to finish. It doesn't have to finish now. Like, this doesn't have to be the end of the debt to the Chinese building cycle and the debt. If they wanted to, they could extend it for a few more years, but we don't think they want to. We think all and the signs are they do want it to slow down. And so, you know, our base case is you'll get something similar to 2015 at least in terms of the markets falling and commodity prices in particular coming off. And then the question there is, do they lose their nerve and go back to building, or do they actually stick with it this time and go with you know, the whole transition phase and the thoughts around, yes, they do want more prosperity for everyone, not just for the property billionaires and others. And I think there's a pretty reasonable case that they may well push further this time, in which case you know, you need to be quite conservative and not look upon, you know, there will be a buying opportunity, but we're only really just getting started.
All right. And so the question of the week we have, 1 second, when did I lose it?
Is Evergrande the tip of the iceberg?
Well, is Evergrande the tip of the iceberg? That's a very, very poignant question. I mean, you know, we've discussed it here. We've seen the potential fallout in other areas, and I think it's going to be an interesting story as it unfolds.
Yep. If viewers here, drop in your thoughts in the comments below. Mm-hmm. Love to see what you've got to think about it.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you, Damien. As usual, right on the pulse of the global economy and the issues that are or should be front of mind for investors around the world. Just a little heads up. Next week, we have Matt Johnson, principal of Signal Macro. He is very focused on macroeconomics, that is central banks, interest rates, foreign exchange markets, and he'll be our guest next week. So do tune in for that. And thanks again for all of you who have watched today.
Actually, quick one. Sorry, Mark, to cut you off. There's just a question just popped in that's actually worth answering. So
apologies.
From David, it's only just popped up. Is there a possibility of money leaving Chinese property market into the Australian and Chinese property market? It's an interesting thought. The pros behind that is, if Chinese people are worried about their market, they will try to shift money elsewhere and get it out of the country and into what they perceive as safer assets. The flip side is the Chinese government is more likely to be putting controls on foreign exchange, and particularly for Australia, you know, we've seen they're trying not to buy as many things as they can from the Australian market. they don't want money flowing out of Australia and into the Chinese, the Australian property market. So on that side, it's no. Canada might be that. I mean, that's probably a better chance, especially given what we saw in terms of
1997, was it? The immigration of money from Hong Kong to Vancouver?
Yeah, but also Meng, sorry, I've forgotten her surname, the executive there who was locked up, the Chinese executive there who was locked up, was released recently. So senior executive within a Chinese company. So she'd been arrested in Canada and looking at being extradited to the US. And she's an executive of Huawei, and China put a lot of diplomatic pressure on Canada. They arrested a couple of Canadian citizens on unrelated issues, you know, in air quotes. And those citizens happened to be released the same day that Canada released this Huawei executive. So, you know, my expectation would be if it was a choice between Australia or Canada, then it's more likely to be flying into Canada. But I think in both cases, there's going to be China will be trying to limit flows out of the country.
Fair enough. One more question.
So another question. What's the risk that the Chinese government will ask Chinese investors to bring money home as they need foreign currency? I think the Chinese government in general is tries not to let people bring money overseas. It's probably more corporates. Could they try and get corporates to bring money home? Maybe. I think that China will certainly be trying to keep the yuan as low as they can to sort of stimulate activity in as they're sort of cracking down on the property sector. They don't want the rest of their exports to fall away as well. That's on one side, but on the other side, you've got that keeps Chinese households poor, and so I think they'll probably err on the side of a lower yuan in the interim. But at some stage, they will need to let their currency go a lot higher if they're genuine about rebalancing their economy and giving more wealth to the average citizen, because the average citizen. The reason why, if they let their currency rise a lot more, then the average citizen can have overseas holidays, can buy things from Europe or buy things from the US. Whereas if they keep their currency artificially low, which is what they've generally been doing, makes it a lot harder for their own citizens to buy things from overseas. But it makes it much easier for them to be a big exporter and get jobs for people. So I think in the short term they'll want to try and focus more on the jobs, but over time they'll be trying to lead back into if they're genuine about rebalancing, they'll need to let the currency rise to let the average person share in the wealth.
I think Nathan was also commenting about whether the Chinese citizens would want to bring money back, and given that a fair chunk of this money could be loosely labeled as grey in nature, that's why they pushed the money out offshore, because if they had it onshore, it would be a real problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right in terms of saying a lot of the money. Well, look, who knows how much of the money? But I think that there's certainly a reasonable amount of it is there because they want it away from where the Chinese government can see it. So
exactly.
Yeah, unlike it's quite hard to pull it back, which is why I'm saying for companies though, it might be easier. That's a question then of whether that's something China does want to do is encourage companies to bring money home.
All right.
Excellent. Okay.
Well, thanks again for all of those of you who have watched this episode live and those of you who've asked questions today as well. We do welcome your feedback on this webinar and any suggestions for future topics. Don't forget to click like on the video now. And finally, if you know someone who might find this video interesting, do share the link with them. If you'd like to see more on our previous webinars, please go to nucleuswealth.com/content. And to stay up to date with us, you can follow us on social media. Thanks again, Damien. And we look forward to you joining us next week at the webinar next week with Matt Johnson.